Blog Talk Radio.
Pop Health Week on the Blog Talk Radio and Affiliate Networks. This episode is brought to you by Health Innovation Media, monitoring and informing best practice pathways to that elusive triple aim. Welcome, everyone. I'm Greg Masters, the producer and co-host of the show. And joining me in the virtual studio is my colleague, Fred Goldstein, principal co-host and co-founder of Pop Health Week. Hey, Fred.
Hello, Greg. How are you this afternoon?
I'm doing great, and understand you're at a conference somewhere in South Florida.
That's correct. I'm down here in Miami at a healthcare payers conference. It's been an excellent day and a half so far with one more day to go. Great discussions on health IT, mobile, population health, all the good things we need to be doing out there.
Excellent. Great to hear that. So for those of you not familiar with my colleague Fred, he is a veteran healthcare executive and president of Accountable Health LLC, a Jacksonville, Florida-based consulting firm and past chair and current board member of the Population Health Alliance, PHA, who is convening in Washington, D.C. on November the 2nd through the 4th, 2015. Join us if you can. Fred's experience spans hospital and health system administration, HMO general management, and is the founder of a disease management company. My background includes thought leadership and consulting support for hospitals, health systems, capitated medical groups, IPAs, PHOs, and MSOs. I publish and principally author ACOWatch.com, founded Health Innovation Media, and I'm known on Twitter as 2HealthGuru. Today, we continue coverage of issues in the emerging population health space, including evidence-based best practices with key thought leaders, innovators, and academicians in the space. Our special guest is Judson Brewer, MD, PhD, founder and research lead at Claritas Mind Sciences, whose mission is to develop and implement evidence-based mindfulness solutions that delight our customers. Their website further notes, the mindfulness training of Claritas Mind Sciences was developed at Yale University School of Medicine by Judson Brewer, MD, PhD. The training principles are based on ancient wisdom traditions that date back thousands of years that have been translated for modern-day use through programs such as mindfulness-based stress reduction. Judson is a thought leader in the science of self-mastery. With 15 years of experience in mindfulness training, he has published numerous peer-reviewed articles and book chapters, spoken at international conferences, and his work has been featured at TEDx, Time Magazine, Forbes, the BBC, NPR, and others. So with that as an introduction, Fred, help us get to know this pioneer in the mind-body connection and why this matters for population health strategists and operators.
Thank you so much, Greg, for that kind introduction. And Judd, welcome to the show today.
No, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. And where are we talking with you from today?
I'm at the Center for Mindfulness at UMass Medical School in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Fantastic. Well, I hope you're having some good weather up there. Let me ask you first, Judd, especially for our audience, who may not have heard of mindfulness, tell us what that is.
Mindfulness, it's actually a buzzword these days, so it's kind of hard to get a good sense for what it actually means. But I like to think of it as, just a way of a particular stance of paying attention to what's actually going on right now in a way that's not, trying to change it or push it away or hold on to it.
So if somebody is mindful, they're in the moment, but they're not of the moment or something like that?
I think that's basically it. So you're paying attention to what's actually going on right here, right now, and you're not just totally railing against it. It doesn't mean that you're not trying to change what's going on or work with the situation, but you're not sitting there with your particular bias, the lens of biased glasses on, you know, like a certain color of glasses, if that makes sense.
So how does somebody become more, I guess, more mindful?
Practice.
Yes.
so we, it's, you know, this ability to be mindful or to pay attention is inherent. You know, we all know how to pay attention. So anybody that's listening to the show, they can see that it doesn't take any effort to listen to the show, that a capacity that we all have. Now, the thing that we can train is when our mind wanders or we're about to check our Twitter feed or about to check our email because we get bored or something like that, that's when we can notice where our mind is, you know, kind of going, drifting off on some habitual autopilot, notice that, and then bring it back to what's actually happening right now.
So how do you take that approach and apply it to cravings or addictions?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, cravings and addictions, you can think of them as the far spectrum of being lost in something. So if the near spectrum is, you know, getting lost in a daydream, not a big deal because we're not going to go to jail for daydreaming. You know, if we get caught up more in those thought patterns, maybe we get stressed out because we, you know, we're worried about something or we're constantly worrying that something's not going to happen. And then the far end of that, you can think of addiction, where we're so caught up in whether it's a craving for a substance or a craving for some behavior that we are doing all sorts of things despite adverse consequences. So how mindfulness helps us with this is first helps us see what we actually get from those behaviors. So with smoking, for example, if somebody, you know, I get a lot of smokers who come in and say, but I actually like to smoke. And we say, okay, great, smoke. But just pay attention when you're smoking. And when they do pay attention when they're smoking, they start to see that smoking in that moment doesn't actually taste as good as they thought it would. You know, like the burning in their lungs, the taste of the cigarette and all that stuff. When they actually pay attention to it, it's not as great as, you know, as they kind of pretend or tell themselves that it is. And when they start to see this, they start to become disenchanted with that behavior, seeing clearly what we get from our action, so that over time those actions lose their pullovers, lose that grab, so that then we can start to change behavior. And that's the second piece of where mindfulness helps, is it can help us notice when we get pulled into an urge to act in some behavior pattern, and then give us tools to be able to ride that out. And I can go into that a little bit if you want.
Yeah, but getting back to that first piece, and you talked about being mindful of an individual smoking, and they suddenly say, wow, this doesn't taste so good, like you said, or, you know, heck, I noticed the smell, I don't like that, or whatever. But there's a chemical reaction going on in their brain that sort of reinforces that whole smoking urge. So how does the mindfulness work up against something like that?
Well, so you're probably talking about the binding to the nicotinic acetylcholine receptors that the nicotine does. Is that what you're talking about?
Correct, sure.
So it turns out that, and I have some colleagues at Yale and elsewhere that have actually studied how many puffs of a cigarette it actually takes to bind those receptors. And you get about 50% binding within 1 to 2 puffs. So where's the rest of that cigarette going? So there's a chemical reaction happening, and, you know, it's affecting our brain, and we're satisfying those receptors and basically training ourselves to smoke more so that we keep satisfying those receptors. So when we stop smoking, for example, those receptors get irritated and they say, hey, where's my nicotine? And then we have all the withdrawal symptoms like irritability, you know, trouble sleeping, things like that. What mindfulness can help us with is to kind of be with those body sensations and see that, oh, that's just restlessness. That's just irritability. That's just not my head exploding. You know, I had a patient come into my office and he said, you know, doc, I feel like my head's going to explode if I don't smoke. And we laughed about it. I said, well, if your head explodes, put the pieces back together and give me a call and we'll document the first case, because, you know, your cravings, these physical sensations aren't going to kill you. Now, that's not all, you know, with alcohol dependence, for example, it can kill you if you don't detox carefully. But with smoking, you know, irritated nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, they're not going to kill you. But what you can learn to do is ride that out so that when you don't feed them, those receptors start to downregulate and rearrange so that your brain gets back to normal where it's used to not having that nicotine around. And that's where the mindfulness helps us kind of break that habit loop where we're otherwise we're just going to feed it the rest of our lives.
So as you talk about, so phase one of the mindfulness thing is to recognize, hey, I'm using this cigarette or a cigar, whatever it is, but it's really not as good as I thought when I think about it, when I'm actually in the process and focus on it. And then secondarily, as I move to the phase of not smoking, you then apply a similar principle to those types of messages you're getting or urges you're getting or, you know, as you said, getting irritable, and apply mindfulness to that too.
Absolutely. The nice thing about this is it's just basically one simple thing that you can use to apply to all of these, and it helps bring to light the unhealthy behaviors, and it also helps bring to light what we're habitually worried about, like, oh, these physical, you know, these withdrawal symptoms are going to kill me. So it's a double-pronged attack with the same type of training. That's the nice thing. It's very simple.
So I could see this, obviously, as I'm thinking through myself, all of the areas you could potentially apply this to, but let's first focus on smoking. You know, you've done some research in that area. What has mindfulness been able to do in terms of reducing smoking in individuals?
Great question. So a couple of years ago, we asked just that question. You know, we were really curious to see if it could actually help change behavior. And smoking, as many people don't know, smoking is actually the hardest addiction to quit. And I had a lot of people come into my study who'd already quit alcohol and they'd quit cocaine and quit other types of, you know, quote unquote hard drugs. But you can reinforce smoking 20 times a day if you just smoke one pack of cigarette. You know, so and you can reinforce this for 20 or 30 years. So that's a lot of times that this process can get reinforced. So we did a randomized controlled trial and just compared mindfulness training to gold standard treatment. So the American Lung Association has a training called Freedom from Smoking that's widely disseminated and used in, I think, all 50 states. And we just randomized people to get one or the other over 8 sessions over a 4-week period. And we found that the mindfulness training was actually twice as good at 4 weeks and about 5 times as good at a 4-month follow-up at helping people quit smoking. We were actually pretty shocked by those results.
Wow, that's fantastic. So it looks like it has some sustainability given that you're out at 4 months and now showing, what did you say, a 5-time better rate than the standard, I guess.
Yes, yes.
And
the gold standard is, sorry, go ahead.
No, please, go on. Cool.
I was just going to say the gold standard is 6 months, but this was our first study and we didn't have, you know, a large amount of funding at the time to study, you know, farther out than 4 months. But 4 months was a pretty good outcome for us.
And you've now taken this approach and applied it, you know, obviously the whole world's going mobile, everybody's got a cell phone, and you're applying it through a mobile technology. Tell me a little bit about how that works.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is, so on the Yale campus, they had to spray paint on the sidewalks, look up at the crosswalks because the students are, like, forgetting how to cross the street. Guess what they're doing? They're looking at their
right.
phones. So we've decided, you know, paradoxically or ironically, to use this technology that's driving us the distraction to actually deliver this treatment in the moment, because context-dependent memory is really critical for an addiction to form and at the same time to break your addiction, because you don't learn to smoke in your therapist's office. You don't learn to smoke in the hospital. You learn to smoke, you know, in your car, on your front porch, outside of work. So it's really helpful if you can actually deliver treatment to your fingertips at that moment that you've got that context-dependent craving arise so they can help you ride it out. So we took our manualized treatment, cut it into bite-sized pieces, and can deliver it through your phone, through videos and through animations and in-the-moment exercises that we couldn't actually do in the clinic, and can package all of that in a nice way that people can get this training. Yeah, you know, it's 21 days, 3 to 10 minutes a day, very little bite-sized pieces that they can really use to ramp up their practice. And then we pair this with an online community where they can get peer support. I can support them, and I can even do a weekly live web-based check-in with these folks to give them tips. You know, where else do you get to check in, you know, with an addiction psychiatrist that founded a program, you know, as part of a digital health solution? So that's how we brought it all together, and that's in clinical trials now.
So you've got this 21-day, you said, 3 to 10-minute program. Give me sort of that one day in the life of a person using your app who's a smoker. Sort of what happens?
Yeah, so a day in the life, it basically starts out where we first teach them how they form this habit. It's really important that they know how they form the habit of smoking so they can learn how to break the habit. It's just like if you're developing a cancer drug, you need to know what the mechanism is so you can target the mechanism. We're doing the same thing. So actually on the first day, they get a little intro video, and then they get a little animation that teaches them how they form associative memories to smoke, you know, whether it's eating a good meal and learning to smoke after they eat, or getting yelled at by their boss and learning to smoke to make themselves feel better. So let's say on day one, a 1 minute or 2 minute video that introduces a program, then they get this animation that kind of teaches them that, and then they get an in-the-moment exercise to smoke, in which some of our patients are like, I thought this was smoking cessation. And you say, okay, bear with us, just smoke, but pay attention. And we walk them through, you know, okay, what's it smell like? What's it taste like? And all this. And, you know, I had one smoker say, you know, after her first mindful smoking exercise, she said, smells like stinky cheese and tastes like chemicals. Yuck. So first time she really pays attention when she smokes. And we're getting this all the time. People are saying, I never really noticed what it was like. And I noticed that I use this to distract myself or I do other things when I smoke. So we have them do that first. And then we give them the homework to just smoke mindfully for the next couple, you know, for the next day. And actually for the next 2 days. And then the next day they set their goals, and then the next day they get an exercise where they learn to start paying attention to their body called a body scan, so they can develop concentration and also start to notice what the body sensations are that make up cravings. The next day they get this exercise called RAIN, where it helps them write out cravings in the moment. So they have to recognize it. That's the R. The A is they have to allow or accept it to be there, because if you're pushing your craving away, you're not going to be able to work with it. And the I is investigation. So they get curious about, what does this feel like in my body? And then the N is note it. So is it tightness? Is it tension? Is it burning? Is it clenching? And then they can start to see that these are just physical sensations that make up their cravings, and they're not this moral imperative to smoke. So that's you know, every day they're getting this, you know, additive bite-sized piece that builds on the next previous day, and they get a little bit of practice that helps them first learn to notice what cravings feel like and then learn how to ride them out.
Wow. And so you've now got this on an app. Individuals, or I guess companies, can purchase the app for smoking cessation programs, or how does that sort of work?
Yeah, so we have two channels. So if a consumer wants to buy it, they can just download it from the cravingtoquit.com website, and they can either get a daily, you know, it's like $1 a day or about $80 for a lifetime membership right now. So we've got these introductory pricing where people can just try it out. We're also working with businesses. We're working with payers. We're working with providers because, as you can imagine, you know, there's a huge cost savings for people to quit smoking, because there's so much lost time in productivity and there's so much lost time in health, because smokers on average go to the doctor more and are sicker longer and take more sick days. So there's this like huge return on investment for employers, especially the folks that are at risk, to help people quit smoking. And even better than that, to do it, you know, kind of on their own time in a way that might really be successful because it's mechanistically based. So we're working with all sorts of different, you know, providers and payers and employers and even, you know, consumers themselves.
Uh-huh. And a quick question again on the process. So if somebody goes through the first 21 days and maybe they struggle a bit and they go use it again, is that sort of the thinking with it?
Yes. And so this is a very individualized and individualizable program. So we've had people that have quit in 14 days and then used the rest of the program to kind of reinforce their training. We've had people that have, you know, haven't gone through it every single day. So they'll go through a day and then a couple, you know, they'll keep doing that. And then a couple of days later, they'll go to the next exercise. And so they might take a couple of months. We've had some people who've gone through the entire program and then started all the way back over from the beginning because, you know, it's a whole different ballgame when you go through it again. So, you know, we have people that run the gamut in terms of quitting quickly and using it as a maintenance treatment, and people who take a little bit longer just based on their own, you know, their own habits and you know, frankly, how motivated they are at first to quit. It's funny, we had one of our first quitters was somebody that worked in a congressman's office who Tim Ryan, the Democrat from Ohio, who's very into mindfulness. He wrote a book called Mindful Nation. And I was showing him this app a couple of years ago, And he had a staff members, you know, was a smoker, and he's like, hey, you know, get over here, try this thing out. You don't have to quit smoking, but just tell me if it's any good. And the poor guy, you know, it's like, you have to obey your congressman.
Right.
I don't, you know how it goes. And so 10 days later, the kid emails me, and he's like, well, you know, I wasn't good, but I went ahead and quit smoking. And, you know, 2 years later, I spoke to him, and he's like, yeah, I'm still quit. This is great. So you never know.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So as I think through, you know, this, as you've applied it to smoking, it seems like this could be applied to a much, much broader number of issues. Is it just related to substance abuse and those kinds of things, or could that mindfulness be applied to other things in the health sector?
So if you look mechanistically at how the neural networks and the processes are set up, the process is called, you've probably heard of this, operant conditioning or reward-based mm-hmm. learning, like positive and negative reinforcement. So this process has been known for a long time, and evolutionarily speaking, it was probably set up so we would remember where food is. So you eat food, it tastes good, it sends a signal to your brain that says, oh, that's, you know, that's survival. So remember what you ate and where you found it. And so you, you know, you have this basic trigger behavior reward process that gets set up. So the most obvious thing to work with next, and this is what we're just about to pilot test in clinical trials, is helping people with stress eating, because they've learned to associate, you know, stress with eating food, because it sends the same dopaminergic signal to their brain as smoking cigarettes does. So we've been pilot testing this for the last year in my outpatient clinic and with other pilot testers, and it seems to work very well for helping people, you know, cut down on their stress eating or their emotional eating. So we'll be, you know, that's one thing we can help with in the healthcare sector is with obesity, because it's, as we all know, that is a huge problem. But the other ones that are obvious would be, you know, opioids, where, and there's an epidemic in Massachusetts and the rest of the country with other types of addictions in general. And then even behaviors, you know, any type of behavioral addiction, like if somebody's, you know, like internet porn or other things like that as well.
Is it possible, you know, maybe this is a bit of a stretch, is it possible to take this approach and apply it to things like adherence with medications or stuff like that, or is that just completely different?
That's a really good question. I would have to look at, you know, I would have to understand what the average person's pain points are around taking medications to be able to see how directly this would apply to that, because you want to look at the reward-based learning. Like, what's their reward for not taking their behavior, like for not taking their medication, for example? And if we could pinpoint what those processes are, then we could apply this directly to those. But I would want to, you know, I kind of take everything from a mechanistic lens, so I really want to understand the mechanism first, and then I could say specifically how this would apply. But the odds are, because so many of these behaviors share this common mechanism, this reward-based learning, there's a likelihood that this could apply to something like that, as long as you're really understanding what, you know, what the behavioral mechanism is behind somebody not taking a medication.
Right. And I can see you were mentioning eating and obesity. I mean, if you tackle the smoking issue and can make a large dent in that, and then apply a similar approach, obviously, to the large issue, we have with obesity, you then you know, really taken out two of the drivers of quite a bit of our current and future health status as a nation, as a global entity, you know, and both from a cost and a productivity and lost life perspective. Pretty amazing. And
right.
So
even if we only got those two, I would be happy. Absolutely.
Right. And then as you talked about, I mean, obviously there's been a big focus out of the White House recently about opioid addiction and prescriptions for opioids. So if you could apply it there, which seems to have a very similar mechanism as you talk about when you deal with rehab and addictions, et cetera, pretty amazing. So given that, are your major targets, we talked about a little bit earlier, are they health plans, employers, and other third party payers in essence, or maybe even provider groups that are taking risk?
Both, actually. Yeah, and we've had interest from all levels here. So both the providers and the payers have shown really big interest because, you know, it's hard and expensive to help people quit smoking, for example, and the obesity epidemic is the same issue.
Right, right. So you're now going to go out and begin to test this food you said cravings or stress eating. Is that it?
Yeah, stress and emotional eating in people who are moderately obese, I think.
And a study like that will take how long to do?
Well, the nice thing is we can do iterative pilot testing, and we've kind of been doing that with the content of this program over the last year. So we over the next couple of months, we've got a partnership with UCSF where they're doing a pilot test, a pilot study of feasibility, and we'll be doing pilot work ourselves, both in my lab as well as with Claritas. And we can do small studies where we can learn a lot about the engagement and other types of things over the course of a couple of months, and then iterate and then do larger studies upon that.
Excellent. How did you get into this area? What motivated you to begin to look at this and try to solve this problem?
I was suffering. no kidding. At the beginning of medical school, back in the 90s, I'd gone through a bad relationship breakup and was having trouble sleeping. And somehow Jon Kabat-Zinn's book landed in my lap and I started meditating my first day of medical school. And I was a molecular biologist. I was, no interest in this at all. But I started learning, oh, this is actually helpful for me. And as I went through my MD PhD program, I started getting into meditation more and more and more. And then when I graduated and started residency, I actually shifted gears entirely from molecular biology to learning neuroimaging and clinical trials so I could actually study this stuff. And, I remember people telling me this was a career killer because I'd done pretty well in graduate school. And, what is this kumbaya stuff that you're going to do? Because back then, this was back in 2004, I think, there were very few studies published and no real randomized trial study published on mindfulness for addictions. And this is a really, can be a really difficult population to treat. I got into it personally, and then I started seeing, wow, this is really helpful. And it seems just like a no-brainer to apply it to my patients because they were speaking the same language as these Buddhist psychologists had been speaking 2,500 years ago when they were working out these mechanisms. And they worked these out without computers, without, lab rats, without any of this stuff, just by observing their own experience. It was really remarkable. So, the short answer to that is I had no idea I was going to be doing this. And, boy, it was a twist for me. But now it just seems like a no-brainer. Like, this is, this is the next era in training. Physical, you probably heard the joke about in the 70s, if you were running, somebody said, "Who's chasing you?" Because it was so ridiculous for people to exercise. Well, now, everybody feels guilty when they don't do their physical exercise for the day. Well, this is the new era. It's going to be mental training, which is the next challenge for people. And I was just out at the U.S. Olympic Committee's training site, training some of their coaches in this mental fitness bit, because they're really good at training their athletes to be physically top flight. But if you're going to win an Olympic gold medal, you've got to be in there mentally as well.
That's just a great way to end the show. And I'm going to tell you what, Jed, we got to get you back on to talk about that aspect of it and delve into this so much deeper. This whole brain-body thing that's been disconnected in the healthcare system for so long is finally coming back together. And I think that's going to create some great things for people as we understand the importance of bringing them both back together. So thank you, Jed, for being on the show.
My pleasure.
And that will have to be the last word for today's broadcast. I want to thank our special guest, Dr. Judson Brewer, for his time and considerable insights today. Do follow the innovative work at Claritas Mind Sciences on Twitter at Claritas Mind and on the web at www.claritasmind.com. We do this weekly on Pop Health Week. And as often as possible, we try to stick to Wednesdays, but sometimes we roll that schedule situationally. So until we meet again, and we do hope to see you in D.C. at the PHA Forum, for Fred Goldstein, this is Greg Masters saying bye now.